everyone, and welcome to Circulating Ideas. I'm your guest host today, Dr. Sarah Clark. I'm Associate Library Director at Rogers State University in Claremore, Oklahoma. I recently completed my PhD in Higher Education Leadership from Oklahoma State University. I can be found at betterlibraryleaders.com, where I blog and will soon be podcasting about all things library leadership. The subject for today is critical librarianship, which CritLib.org defines as a movement of library workers dedicated to bringing social justice principles into our work in libraries. I explored elements of critical information literacy in my dissertation and also have a chapter coming out in Critical Literacy for Information Professionals, edited by Sarah McNichol and published by Facet Publications. Steve asked me to step in for him to host Circulating Ideas' first conversation on critical librarianship, and I was delighted to say yes. Our goal for today is to provide an overview of critical librarianship, discuss its relevance to current issues in library science, and to provide a starting point for librarians who are interested in putting the ideas of critical librarianship into practice. Today's guest is Jacob Berg. Jake is senior librarian at the Stephen Lowe Information Center of the Foreign Service Institute of the United States Department of State via the LAC Group. He previously served as director of library services at Trinity Washington University, holding that position from 2011 to 2015. He lives in Washington, D.C. with his wife, two kids, two dogs, and blogs about libraries and beer at beerbrarian.blogspot.com. You can find him on Twitter at Jacob S. Berg. Welcome to Circulating Ideas, Jake.
Thank you, Sarah. It's good to be here.
Great. It's great to have you here. Now, my first question is, how did you discover critical librarianship, both the concept and what's become a rather famous hashtag, the CritLib hashtag?
Okay, I suppose what we'll do is, at least for me, I'll start with how I discovered critical librarianship. I have a background in political science, which I get to put to good use now at the State Department.
Yeah.
But prior to that, I was in a PhD program.
Oh, that's right. I did read that.
For political science at the George Washington University, where I came across a fair amount of critical theory and was interested in it. And upon obtaining an MLIS, I took a course in cataloging. I saw the book Radical Cataloging. It's an edited volume. There are some names in there that I think will be familiar to a fair number of listeners. Jeffrey Beal has a chapter. Emily Drabinsky has a chapter.
Yes.
And as part of an assignment for a cataloging course at the University of Pittsburgh, where I got my MLIS, I discovered this book. I had another critical librarianship participant, Maria Accardi, as a teaching assistant. And I just kind of sort of took off. And this was probably 5 or 6 years ago.
Right.
Actually, 6 or 7 years ago now. And you can fast forward to a couple of years ago, having met, you can put that in quotation marks, people like Emily Drabinsky, Nicole Pagowski, and Annie Fu, all librarians, all active on Twitter.
Yes.
They had discussed coming up with a group, which I think really became that hashtag. I'm going to pronounce it CritLib.
Yes.
We can have like a GIF versus GIF style argument about
there
this.
There we go. If you'd like.
And I think that they came up with that. Maybe that's a way to keep each other accountable as they learn together about both critical theories, applying critical theories to librarianship, but also just being critical about practices that librarians do.
Right. Yeah, I sort of, that sounds very similar to my journey. I came to critical librarianship both a little earlier and a little later. I had been introduced to an extent to critical theory in my undergraduate work. I read some Foucault and, you know, some of those classical readers in some philosophy courses. And then honestly, I drifted away from it for years. The kinds of things I read in my master's program were more of your kind of typical John Dewey kinds of theory. But When I started my PhD work, I was introduced to Paulo Freire and his critical pedagogy in a course I took on basically critical theory in higher education. And so I was curious to find out, okay, does critical theory have any role to play within libraries? And then I started searching around, and that is where I discovered Sanford Berman and the work that was being done in cataloging. And then eventually I ran into James Ellenborg and critical information literacy. And then I decided to take a look on Twitter and see if anybody else was interested. And that's how I found the hashtag, which has informed my understanding of the practice of critical librarianship as much as anything else.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah. So how would you define critical librarianship?
This is tricky, because I think that you can really get at it in at least two ways.
Mm-hmm.
One is the application of critical theory to librarianship.
Right.
Coming from various traditions of, you know, sociological theory, structuralism, post-structuralism. Lydia Willoughby has an excellent slide deck sort of discussing where critical theories come from with regards to humanities, sort of text and subtext with regards to literature.
Right.
So that's one side of it. And I think that side can often be seen as intimidating and even pretentious.
Yeah.
The second way is really, I just think, thinking critically, acting critically about what we do as librarians, what we do, how we do it, why we do it.
Mm-hmm.
And in our practice of librarianship, asking ourselves, you know, who benefits from our work?
Right. And Freire, who has a very intimidating name, but his work is actually very readable and approachable. And I recommend Pedagogy of the Oppressed to anybody who wants kind of more of a theoretical grounding that's still readable in critical librarianship. I mean, he's talking about critical pedagogy in general, but it is all very transferable to librarianship and information literacy. He's very focused on taking, you know, these theories and these models and taking them out of kind of the ivory tower setting, which is in itself a kind of power structure, and putting Absolutely. to work in kind of this problem posing dialect where everybody's kind of on the same level and you start kind of constructing meaning together, as opposed to us, you know, standing on, you know, the sage on the stage, just kind of filling everybody's heads with knowledge.
Yes. I mean, I want to second this point. Pedagogy of the Oppressed was a book that I read as an undergrad,
mm-hmm.
and I was able to grasp it with relative ease. It's not a large, long book by any stretch of the imagination, and to me, it really is an aha moment.
Yeah.
Meanings, knowledge, information, the way it's transmitted, the way it's created,
mm-hmm.
can be done in a much more collaborative way than I think is traditionally thought of. And as you say, that has very important, powerful implications for librarianship.
Yeah, yeah. And as far as how I might define critical librarianship, I feel somewhat similar to you in that whether it's through theory or through just critiquing our practice and our practices, it is about taking a critical look at what we do and why we did it. In my dissertation work, I was looking at the information seeking experiences of Comp 2 students, basically who they asked for help with information seeking and what happened in those search mediation encounters. And they found useful help from all over the place. And so it was useful to me, not just as somebody who was interested in researching information, but also as a practicing information librarian, information literacy librarian, to just, you know, shut up and listen to these guys tell me how their information seeking journeys took place. And it was really fascinating, and it really kind of calls some of the things that we do into kind of question. So it was fascinating, and really we all just need to listen to our students more.
Hear, hear.
Yes. And it seems like the critical librarianship movement is really interested in empowering those, like those Comp 2 students I was talking about, who have traditionally been less powerful due to class, race, sexuality, gender identity, any number of things. In what ways do you think critical librarianship differs from, you know, things like the diversity movement of a decade or two ago? And what ways does it extend kind of beyond those obvious and more traditional ways that libraries and librarians have tried to make room for new voices?
I think this is a fascinating question. Librarianship writ large is not a very diverse place.
Nope.
There are many sad statistics that can speak to that. Going beyond diversity, it's also not a very inclusive place at times. And that is people who are traditionally marginalized, historically underrepresented, do not always feel as welcome as they otherwise could.
Mm-hmm.
Diversity is somewhat problematic.
Yes, it is. And maybe explain why that is.
Well, a lot of times when you're in a situation where people talk about diversity, mm-hmm. they're not necessarily talking about inclusion. They're talking about numbers.
Yes.
It leads itself towards what is known as tokenism.
Uh-huh.
They have representatives from historically marginalized, underrepresented groups.
Yes.
And you have them, in, at least in some part, just for the sake of having them.
Yes, I remember this was before my library days. What I always think of as kind of the perfect example of diversity. My first job out of college, I worked for a telecom company, and for reasons probably beyond understanding, they invited me into the leadership trainee program, which was very prestigious. And there were six of us new hires in this class, four white males, me, and one African-American male. And the first time all six of us sat together at a table, we just kind of glanced at each other and went, "Hi." Because, yeah, that's what diversity used to be like. And we need to, I agree, it's time to move beyond just getting the seat at the table and really adding those perspectives to the conversation.
Yeah, and I think that's where critical librarianship comes in, is pushing beyond that towards inclusion, which is inviting people who haven't always been at that table, not only to that table, but to have a voice. Making sure that there is room for them in decision-making structures.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be about sharing power.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And sharing power can also happen between, not just among librarians, but between librarians and our patrons. For instance, in critical information literacy, it's taking these ideas of critical pedagogy and taking them into the classroom. How could librarians kind of engage in this sort of what Ferry calls a problem-posing model of library instruction, where it becomes, you know, more of a participatory thing? I mean, I know we talk a lot about making our instruction more of a dialogue, but how can we kind of get beyond that into where everybody in the information literacy classroom or in a reference and interview kind of is working towards making meaning together?
I wish I had the answer to this. I'm not sure that there is mm-hmm. the answer. I think that there are many answers. There are certainly different ways of getting about that.
Right.
Part of the CritLib chats are sort of a way for librarians, library staff, to share techniques, to discuss successes, to discuss failures. I know I've certainly had a bunch of failures with regards to this. Mm-hmm. As well. I've certainly changed how I've taught information literacy library instruction sessions based off of this CritLib learning community.
Well, in what ways?
Much less emphasis on lecturing.
Yeah.
I've tried to change the setting from classrooms to computer labs,
mm-hmm.
give students agency to allow them fair amount of leeway with regards to exploration of library resources.
Right.
Trying to move beyond the research paper as sort of the be-all, end-all of undergraduate instruction, mm-hmm. at least in the humanities and social sciences, towards more collaborative projects, toward projects where people collaborate. Way back when, this Web 2.0 was all the rage.
Ah, yes. Now, when you talk about collaborative projects, that's good to a point, but how do you make those sorts of things happen when you've got a one-shot instruction session with a Comp 1 class where they have to learn how to find 3 peer-reviewed searches? Is that a matter of educating faculty members and asking them to retool their assignments, or is that a matter of how do you balance basically meeting the goals that they will need to, complete the assignment versus helping them think about and engage with information kind of this more critical, empowered, expansive way?
Yeah, and I mean, to me, this is a situation that many librarians, myself included, have found themselves stuck in before.
Me too.
I think that if you've taught information literacy, either at the high school level, at the college level, perhaps even at the junior high, middle school level, you've probably come up against this where faculty want what faculty want.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certainly battles that we have to pick and choose. I've been going to faculty ahead of time, beforehand, and having them rethink the research paper.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what if we created this digital portfolio, so this compendium, this body of work?
Right.
That might be a bit more applicable to what they do after they graduate. So that's one such option.
Mm-hmm.
With some faculty are more receptive to it than others.
Right.
There is the danger, because this way is not without its problems either, that, when you have people collaborate and create a digital portfolio, to what extent are you, sort of complicit in this strange careerism?
Right.
And I say this as someone who comes from a liberal arts background, very much believes in the liberal arts mission. Learning is its own reward.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to learn for one's sake. It's important to learn how to learn.
Yeah. But see, that's a tension in my practice because I work at a public regional state university. I care very much about our mission. We have a lot of first generation students, a lot of underrepresented students, a lot of non-traditional students.
Yes, this was the case at Trinity as well.
Yeah, who are very smart and very hardworking. But, yes, I can also help them learn to critique the power structures involved in information. But I also understand that, they have a genuine need to be able to write the thing, to get the grade, to graduate, to get the decent job, to, put food on the family and help their, and it's this tension I think a lot of us feel between, in what ways, how do we balance those things to truly help them reach all of their goals?
Yeah. And for a lot of first generation college students, it's a tension as well,
mm-hmm.
because perhaps they want to major or minor in something, but feel pressure to major or minor in something otherwise.
Right. And I guess that's just, one of those things that we have to, maybe what we do is we learn to kind of live in that tension as professionals ourselves and acknowledge those things. And maybe by our exploring it, we can sort of help students explore those things and start struggling with how they strike those balances in their own lives.
I absolutely agree. I mean, I don't have a lot of solutions, but mm-hmm. identifying problems is, I think, a good place to start.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And kind of moving on from information literacy, another aspect of critical librarianship revolves around kind of critically looking at the ways we categorize and describe information, be that cataloging or citation styles. For me, as I mentioned earlier, my introduction to that was reading about Sanford Berman and the ways that he sort of started critiquing the Library of Congress subject heading and finding all of these, you know, appalling kinds of languages and constructions. I think something else that pops up to me, because my university has a very large Native American student population, also very a large Native American collection. If you look at where it goes in the Library of Congress classification system, all the Native American stuff is like squished into this very small section of the classification. Everything's got like 15 decibel points next to it. And it's just, it's interesting in the ways that we've constructed how we organize information. In what ways do we kind of build those power structures into the ways that we categorize and describe information?
Yeah, I mean, librarianship, as was mentioned earlier, is white. And it was white. And so that when you see an author like Ernest Hemingway, it's categorized as fiction.
Right.
And then when you see an author like Ralph Ellison, it's categorized as African American.
Mm-hmm.
And no one discusses Ernest Hemingway's whiteness. Right.
What?
It's just taken for granted that sort of that's the standard.
Yeah, absolutely. And those assumptions kind of got built into these structures. So how are librarians who are involved in the CritLib, CritLib movement trying to call these things into question?
I mean, one example from current events is a group of students and librarians from Dartmouth petitioning the Library of Congress to change a subject heading from illegal aliens to something that acknowledges the humanity of people who are coming into the United States.
Right.
And making that a bit more people-centric.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the reason that they're initially called illegal aliens is a tax status. They're not aliens, tiny,
right,
you know, green anthropomorphic looking things and flying saucers. You know, that they're actual people.
Right.
And I think that one thing that is discussed a fair amount in critical theory is the power of language.
Yes.
The way that language sort of, you know, discourses have power. And what would it look like if we had never called people illegal aliens? What if we had treated them more like people than as opposed to combining a word that is against the law with a tax status?
Right.
How would that reframe the debate around this issue? So petitioning the Library of Congress is one way to do this.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly have other thoughts here with regards to the Rahul cataloging book that got me interested. I proposed that what the Library of Congress do was to really sort of historicize subject headings and the catalog so that librarians, people who were interested in looking up materials in a catalog could look and sort of see the evolution of terminology. Obviously, that's a huge project.
Right.
I am free to discuss it at the theoretical level, what that would actually entail in changing it, so that you could mention, oh, by the way, Ernest Hemingway is a white man.
Yeah.
And no doubt his whiteness and his maleness informed and influenced in explicit and implicit ways his work.
Right. Well, and that would be a lovely thing to look at and figure out how that we could incorporate into the Library of Congress subject headings. But of course, we've already had a congressman introduce a bill trying to ban the Library of Congress from changing those headings because they want to keep it illegal alien. how do we respond when these kinds of situations arrive where we're trying to go in this political direction, this critical direction of reframing how we understand patrons, how we understand information, and then we start getting this pushback from the existing power structures?
So this is interesting, because you mentioned that librarians are the ones getting political, right? And that takes for granted that politics was absent from anything prior to us simply as librarians.
And of course it wasn't.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that critical librarianship really gets at is that we're not neutral.
Right.
States, Western culture, whether it's libraries as institutions, whether it's librarians as people, we all have biases.
Yeah. My implicit bias just showed up, and I've got a PhD in this stuff. So, you know, we're never going to be perfect, but it's working towards that.
Yeah. But I mean, even if the congresswoman from Tennessee succeeds in reinstating illegal aliens as a subject heading, there are still things that catalogers could do at the individual level. We, and I say this as someone with the background in technical services,
right,
can still catalog more humanely. That is, we can mark up records in whatever schema standard format we'd like, full of keywords of things that people might actually search for.
Right.
I think, might be on some level dehumanizing for someone who's classified as an illegal alien to have to type in that phrase. Librarians, we make things findable, searchable, discoverable. We can use better terminology that's like more empathetic, more reflective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a good point. Coming at it, it's interesting because I'm more on the public services side of the fence, and you're more on the technical services side of the fence. And it's interesting to hear kind of you describing the ways that we as individual practitioners could work around some of these obstacles while working to change the larger structures. And focusing on public services, many libraries, especially public libraries, all continuing to explore kind of the best ways to serve disadvantaged patrons, what maybe 10 or 15 years ago we might have called problem patrons and what might still be called problem patrons by some. These are folks who may be dealing with challenges such as homelessness or mental illness or other socioeconomic issues. How can we reframe our thinking and approach to these patrons in a way that helps us engage with them as people, not as, quote, problems?
This is one of the real tragedies, I think, of where critical librarianship is as of right now.
Okay.
I've heard it expressed in multiple venues by multiple people, enough that it's no longer anecdotal, that to some extent critical librarianship is unwelcoming, indifferent, or even hostile towards public librarians.
Yeah.
And I suspect that this podcast may be somewhat contributing to that. You have myself as a quasi-academic special librarian with an academic librarian background.
Yeah.
We're an academic librarian. We are 30-plus minutes into this discussion. We've really talked a lot about academic libraries and academic library issues. And so I don't know how many public librarians are still listening to this, which is a shame.
Yeah.
Because I think the people who really embody this combination of theory and practicing librarianship that we like to call praxis are public librarians. We talk about problem patrons from traditionally marginalized, underrepresented backgrounds.
Right.
Are much more likely to be acquainted with things like the surveillance state. That people like Michel Foucault have written about, the sort of like always visible, always policed, always watched.
Right.
Right. And there are a great number of survival strategies and skills that quote unquote problem patrons have that when they perform these behaviors, these practices, that only sort of compounds their mm-hmm. problemness. Oh,
right.
Look at that person over there. They're doing X, Y, and Z. But they have very good reasons for doing X, Y, and Z historically.
Exactly, exactly.
But I've seen more and more public libraries bringing in social workers. Mm-hmm. Is, I think, excellent. I live in Washington, D.C., and so here I can shout out D.C. Public Libraries, which does this at their main branch, MLK Library. San Francisco does this as well. I think it's an excellent first start. Please treat your patrons well. Acknowledge their humanity. Be empathetic. You know, and it's those are things that I think it's hard to do in the moment.
Yeah.
But part of critical librarianship is sort of, you know, training yourself to be in that moment.
And to be uncomfortable.
Yeah. Like, it is okay to be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I can bring up one more public library.
Yeah. Yeah.
Book challenges.
Oh.
Like, you don't see an awful lot of those in academic libraries where, despite, you know, this rampant discussion of, you know, political correctness that's come back
mm-hmm.
in higher education, books don't get challenged, right? Like, I could buy a copy of Charles Murray's The Bell Curve,
right,
which makes some rather hideous arguments about yep. the relationship between race and IQ and why that relationship might be one way.
Mm-hmm.
And people who will disagree with Dr. Murray will still appreciate that we have that book, so that then they can cite it and refute it with mountains of evidence that points otherwise.
Right.
But if I'm a public librarian and I have a children's book about two gay penguins who live in the Central Park Zoo,
mm-hmm.
I might be hearing about it from parents and other people in the community who don't think that that's appropriate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, you know, what do you do if you want to foster an environment of inclusiveness? What do you do for LGBT youth?
Right.
Who are researching, like finding out who they are in a public library if those materials aren't there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. We have to find ways to include all of those stories and all of those perspectives into our collections. And, into our practice. I mean, for me, it keeps kind of coming back to empathy. How can we try to bring that empathy more into our practice?
It's a great question. Practice makes perfect. Take deep breaths, meditation, yoga, go to your happy place. Check in with each other. And that is, hey, I'm a librarian. I did it this way. I don't feel good about it. What can I do next time? And to me, that's a big part of the Crit Lib chats on Twitter.
Yeah, yeah. Is we can go there and we can kind of confess, I messed up. I did this. How can I do better next time? And it's interesting. I hadn't really thought about that. But self-care is kind of important to us as we try to maintain that critical stance. Before, I actually worked my way through library school as a welfare caseworker, you know, food stamps and such. And I had to learn a lot of that in that job. And I have taken some of that with me to the library world. And I think it's important for us to kind of think about the ways that we can take care of ourselves and each other.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and do try and put yourself in your patron's shoes. You know, picture what they're going through, how you would want to be treated. It's something, you know, two things that I ask for in job interviews, or at least I ask about, are,
mm-hmm.
have you ever had a bad experience in the library? And if so, tell me about it.
Ooh.
And then second, have you ever worked retail or something forward facing?
Mm-hmm.
Just so that, you know, you interact with large swaths of humanity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I like that bad experience in libraries questions. I may steal that. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Cause I think it's important because honestly, most of us got into the library world because we're the nerds.
Yep.
And we're the people who are just innately comfortable in libraries and with information. And yet we are the people who are also called, if I can be forgiven to use a word like calling, to help, you know, help people who are not as at home naturally in the library connect with the information that they need.
Hear, hear.
Yeah. And that's, and then we get back to the empathy and to the listening and to putting yourself in your patron's shoes, looking at the world kind of from the other side of the reference desk and understanding those things. I'm an aspiring library leader, hence the whole higher ed degree. But I also care about taking these critical theories that I learned in my coursework and the student voices I heard in my dissertation and putting them all to work in the libraries that I serve. How can librarians and library leaders especially kind of negotiate the tension we were just talking about between using our power within kind of the current structures to keep the library as a safe space for those kinds of problem-posing education and critical inquiry versus interrogating our own power and our own role as sort of creators and supporters of what Freire would be calling the banking model of information?
Yes. My answer to the question is yes. And it's not a yes or no question.
Right.
I mean, you know as well as I that to be in middle management
mm-hmm.
at a university is often a very odd place to be when you're attempting to look out for staff, other library workers, librarians, student workers, and affect change, but at the same time deliver the goods to academic administration.
Exactly. And also,
there's a real tension there.
Yeah, we live within structures, but our structures live within our larger structures. A public library may report to a board, but that may be within a larger, you know, a small piece of the larger city or county government. My university, you know, my library, we, you know, report to the provost and the president of our university, but my university is one of several regional state universities in a state that has budget challenges, and even the even the universities themselves are probably going to be having to grapple with some sort of, you know, budget cut. This is no secret. The state of Oklahoma is like over $1 billion in the hole right now. And so it's like, you know, we struggle with asserting our own power, and we see that the institutions of higher education, if you're not in a flagship, sometimes those are disadvantaged within the larger power structure.
Yeah. I mean, even if you look at, say, what's happening in the University of Wisconsin system right now.
Oh, yeah.
Even if you are in a flagship.
Mm-hmm.
These are, I think, sometimes hard times for higher education.
Yeah.
As they are for public libraries as well with regard to budgets.
Yeah.
It's not easy to try and make a dollar out of 15 cents.
No.
To that end, I push open access, open educational resources wherever I can. I'm not sitting on giant piles of State Department cash right now. I mean, I've got budgets to deal with here as well.
Yeah.
No, I'm selling what I'd like them to be.
Yeah.
How to manage.
Mm-hmm.
From a sort of critical librarianship perspective is, I think, a fascinating question.
Yeah.
We've both mentioned empathy multiple times. I think that plays a role. I know that I can't make my decision-making structures flat, that there's going to be a hierarchy there.
Right.
But I do try to keep an open door. I do try to listen. I do try to reciprocate. I try to, when I ask someone for something, if I can help alongside them, I try to do that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, and it has to go beyond, you know, the library director taking a turn at the reference desk. It has to, you know, it has to be as collaborative as possible, I think. Library leadership is, you know, because you need to get all of the voices on your team together to understand the problem, you know, look at the elephant from as many angles as possible. So you're not just seeing the one part and figure out what the best thing is, you know, what the best thing is. Again, always keeping your patron central.
Yeah. And this does tie back into issues of diversity and inclusion that, that were discussed at the outset, is that having multiple points of view, from people who feel empowered can really, really help you as a library manager.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, how can those of us who, you know, enthusiastically embrace CritLib as an important part of the future of our libraries, how can we communicate with colleagues who are either unfamiliar or outright suspicious of theories that call us to critique the power structures that we've drawn on for our legitimacy?
I guess one thing to do, and I think that the chats have gotten much better at this and done a good job recently.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody can post a chat. Though, you know, the CritLib hashtag was created by these people over here.
Right.
It is, I think, you know, despite some misgivings and some tension with public librarians,
mm-hmm.
a welcoming and inclusive community. We had someone propose a chat on sort of critical librarianship and prison libraries.
Oh, wow. I'm sorry. I missed that.
Yeah. The person who proposed this is not a prison librarian, has never been a prison librarian, and proposed it because they wanted to learn more about it and to then, you know, be connected with prison mm-hmm. librarians. The theories behind CritLib, I think some people find the terminology alienating.
Right.
Others find it, you know, per bell hooks, empowering. That, you mm-hmm. know, this ability to put a name to something that had plagued you and that lets you know, that you're not alone in it, can be empowering.
Yeah.
You know, to name the problem is to sort of, you know, a starting point in tackling it and interrogating it.
Yeah.
I would say the chats themselves have done a much better job of not necessarily being about theory. And
yes.
again, you don't need, and I guess this is like a PSA for whoever is still listening, you don't need any background knowledge of critical theory to participate in a critical librarianship
mm-hmm.
chat.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very
like,
true.
Just, you know, think about why you do what you do, how you do it, how it could be improved, how we can support each other. I mean, bidden or not, that theory is present. It exists, and you can engage with it if you find it helpful, but you don't necessarily have to, and you don't necessarily need any background in critical theories of librarianship.
Right. If there is someone who's kind of spent some time lurking on the CritLib hashtag or is just interested by our conversation, I hope we've like not put everybody to sleep, and they're ready to learn more, but maybe find the notion of jumping straight into, you know, Foucault or Freire a little too intimidating, what might be some good resources for them to start with?
There's a Zotero group, and I can count out the URL. It's zotero.org mm-hmm. / CritLib. That may be a half a decent place to start. If the theory is really what's intimidating, there's a series of X for beginners.
Right.
I once walked in to a graduate seminar with structures and post-structures for beginners. It's basically like a 200-page graphic novel.
Oh, I've seen those. Yes. Yeah.
And the, you know, the professor was at first, I think, tickled and thought it funny. But then when I showed the professor the contents, he was like, wow, this is absolutely fantastic. This is great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I sort of think of it as like, you know, X for Dummies.
Yeah. I've read those. They're wonderful.
It's approachable. I think that you can always just use the hashtag and sort of jump in, like, where do I start?
Mm-hmm.
Also, this website, critlib.org.
I was about to mention them. Yes, that website is wonderful because it's just kind of, and it's get engaged in kind of the practice aspects of things as well as the theory.
Yeah.
And it has, that's where a lot of the archives of the chats are stored as well. A lot of them are linked there. So, and we'll put a link to those, all those resources that we've been talking about in the show notes. One of the things that most appeals to me about critical librarianship is that most librarians in this movement, as you've been talking about, we've gotten to the point where most of us want to put these theoretical concepts to work in our professional lives. Kind of what are some good tactics to take these ideas of critical librarianship out of the hashtag and into our practice, or as the critical theorists say, praxis?
I would say, and this is maybe an uncrit-lib thing to say, would be to start small.
Yes.
You don't have to go out there and advocate for, you know, some sort of, you know, anarcho-syndicalist, you know, post-Marxist, burn it all down, you know, everyone up against the wall, you know, revolution.
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of small things in everyone's libraries that I think can be interrogated and then made somewhat more empathetic and accessible.
Right.
It can be open access. It could be making the catalog a bit more humane. It could be practices at the reference desk, at the circulation desk. It could be how you treat library staff. If there's a professional sort of, and then to use this word that I'm sorry, like paraprofessional divide.
Yeah.
You know, how can you go about bridging those sorts of things? There are plenty of smaller projects that can be tackled. Mm-hmm. And I think mindfulness is very important.
Yeah, and also kind of some of the things we talked about earlier about, you know, just self-care and, you know, and we keep going back to empathy.
Yep.
You know, finally, in addition to being somewhat known in the critical librarianship world, you are also known as a connoisseur of fine beers, hence your blog being titled Beerbrarian.
Yes.
Are there any parallels between critical librarianship and beer?
I will say that the beer world makes the library world look diverse by comparison, which is a sad statement about race, gender, class, access to capital.
Right.
Things that certainly all play a role in who does or does not become a librarian certainly manifest themselves even more so in who or, you know, who does not make beer. That's not necessarily at the homebrew level, although homebrewing is also overwhelmingly white and male, but much more about at the professional level and what can be done to create both a more diverse and a more inclusive environment there as well. I'm a person who likes to discuss sort of why they like what they like. So that's sort of being self-critical.
There you go.
Beer very much lends itself towards that as well.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm searching for a connection here.
There we go. Yeah. That sounds good. I like that one. How can folks find out more about you?
I blog rather infrequently now.
Mm-hmm.
That was mentioned at the outset. It's beerbrarian.blogspot.com. You can certainly find me on Twitter at Jacob S. Berg. Real name, no gimmicks there. I think it keeps me in check.
Yep.
That makes me somewhat accountable both towards myself and the larger public if, you know, my name is out there. I would say that Twitter is probably the best way to get in contact with me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're listening out there and you'd like to say hi, please come say hi.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this was a fascinating conversation today, and thank you so much for your time. And I hope some folks get some use out of this. And if you have any questions about critical librarianship or anything else, check in with Jake on Twitter. And thank you again so much for coming on the show today.
Cool. And thank you very much for hosting. I appreciate the opportunity.
Wonderful.
Hey, it's Steve. Thanks to Sarah and Jake for the great conversation about critical librarianship. Jake has been on my list to be on the show for a very long time, so I'm glad he was finally able to be on, even if it was not with me as the interviewer. But that just means the next time Jake and I are in the same place, we will have to just get together informally and chat over some kind of drink. Wine, is that what he likes to drink? I'm a little baffled. He could be more clear as to what his drink preferences are. Be sure to check out Sarah's site at betterlibraryleaders.com. And if you want to continue the conversation about critical librarianship, especially you public librarians out there who I'm sure did listen to this whole episode, head over to Twitter and use the hashtag CritLib to read up on the conversation and then to contribute yourself. Circulating Ideas is produced by Steve Thomas in the suburbs of Atlanta. Music is by Pamela Klicka. If you'd like to learn more about the show, listen to past episodes, or read transcripts, visit circulatingideas.com. You can follow the show on Twitter at CircIdeas, like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas, or drop me an email at mail@circulatingideas.com. If you'd like to support the show, visit patreon.com/circideas, and please rate, review, and recommend the show on iTunes, Overcast, Stitcher, or your podcast app of choice to help others find the show. Thank you for listening, and keep circulating the ideas.
Was there anything that you wanted to hit that we didn't touch on?
I don't think so.
Okay.
But also, you know, 30 seconds after the fact.
Right. If you think of something like later tonight or tomorrow, let me know and we can hop on Skype and do it real quick. So
yeah, I mean, now that I have this functioning headset.
Always a nice touch.
Yeah, the world is my oyster.